the first thing that I do is I tell myself that I'm ready to give it a try. Give it a try.
Yeah.
Next thing, I tell myself that it's going to work out, right?
Mm-hmm.
I may not like the results, but it's going to work out. I'm going to be okay. You know, and then I tell myself that my personal experience is not that different than other people's. And I think that that's something I try to tell my skiers a lot. Hey, what you're experiencing out here, everyone else is going through it too. It's just what you do with it.
Welcome to the Good Life Central Oregon Podcast, where we pursue the good life by helping you pursue yours.
Goes out to our sponsor, RE/MAX Revolution and Sisters. RE/MAX is the number one real estate company in the world, and RE/MAX Revolution offers new solutions for better results. Go to ilovecentraloregon.com to find out more.
We have Ben Huseby is my next guest on the Good Life Central Oregon podcast. Ben, will you say hello to everyone?
Hello, thanks for listening in.
As we mentioned in the intro, Ben has done a variety of things, including instructing kids and being a high-level skier, but we're going to jump into the conversation and get to the rest of the meat and potatoes of this interview. Ben, tell us what you do right now.
Right now, I have two primary responsibilities with the Bend Endurance Academy. I serve as the executive director, and I'm also the Nordic program director.
Nordic, so cross-country skiing?
Yes.
Does that include skate skiing and skiing in general?
It's people call it Nordic skiing now. You might know it as cross-country skiing. Some people like to refer to it as skate skiing, but the act itself encompasses... Nordic skiing encompasses jumping, Nordic combined, which is jumping and cross-country skiing in the skating style, and then cross-country ski racing involves skating or classic style. And so it's basically we teach both classic and skating skiing here, and we call it Nordic skiing.
Okay, so we'll probably need to dive into that a little bit more because I can count how many times I've cross-country skied on one hand, which includes last February when we had a huge snow dump, was skiing out of my garage across town to go get some eggs and milk and skiing back home.
Which is a great experience.
Which was awesome. That was quite a thing.
Yes.
But, and then, so tell us more about the Bend Endurance Academy.
We're coming up on our sixth year, and we run programs in rock climbing, cycling, and in Nordic skiing. And our mission is to promote healthy living through active outdoor experiences. We emphasize teamwork, personal growth, and community responsibility. We have about 600 participants presently.
Are these participants all kids, or is it kids and adults? Who's the program for?
It's mostly kids. And I would say that our largest group is in the 8 to 14 year old category. We do have some adult programs. They're mostly in Nordic skiing, and they mostly center around skate skiing.
So I'm gonna press a little pause button on that, on the Bend Endurance Academy, because we're gonna bring that back around full circle at the end, I suspect. I want to go back to the beginning of where you became a skier and ultimately became an educator. How did that come about?
I started cross-country skiing, which is what it was called back then, in 1972. And I grew up in the Minneapolis area, and I was enthralled by snowmobiles as a child. I used to draw them on sheets of paper. Their tracks, the skis, the machines, the people on the machines. And I really wanted one. And one day my parents came home with a carload full of Nordic or cross-country ski equipment. And they handed me a pair and said, go entertain yourself. And that's how it started.
Don't get in any trouble. See you later.
Exactly.
Come in for dinner.
Basically.
Really?
Yeah.
And then, and how old are you at this time, did you say?
7.
About 7. Mm-hmm. So here's some skis. Don't break an arm. Go.
Yep.
And so what did you do with a bunch of skis?
I did what all kids would do. I went and found the biggest hill I could find and built a jump and practiced going off of it.
Oh, I'm just thinking about the possibilities. You've got a carload full of skis. I'm thinking, you know, catamaran style skiing and, you know.
Minnesota is a cold place. It's a dark place. It doesn't get a lot of snow. And when the snow does fall, oftentimes there's a big freeze thaw that goes with it. So, you know, the snow is firm. Grooming was basically non-existent at that time.
And was ice skating and hockey out of the question?
I did play hockey and I did ice skate. But it was much easier for me to just, I wasn't particularly drawn to team sport. And so it was easier for me to just, I liked being outside. So it was really easy for me to put the skis on and go explore. And we lived right next to a golf course. That was how I spent my time.
Is there such a sport as ski and golf? Kind of like the modern biathlon?
I've got to think that someone back there has tried it.
I would imagine.
Yes.
Too tempting not to.
You know, and nowadays with everybody inventing sports all of the time, I'm sure someone's tried it.
And I just ran into someone actually at the Little Woody Beer Fest. I ran into a guy up in Washington that they play the four wheel, the four wheeler polo.
Polo.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Yeah. There's a shout out to my new friend Juan who told me about that. So I'll have to.
I'm sure it's cheaper than having horses.
But I mean, wow, creating new sports and just having fun with it. Anyway, back to skiing in Minneapolis. So talk me through the transition of just being a kid who was getting out and didn't have a lot of other options, if I'm jumping to the right conclusion, to becoming a high-level skier.
The competitive side of it came from a different angle. I did a lot of exploring as a kid. And I had a bow and arrow actually, and I used to rabbit hunt on my skis.
Oh, nice.
And we moved to another part of the city, and again, next to a school, this time it was near a school.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was open space.
Mm-hmm.
And I started making my own trails, and I started packing them in and skiing in the track, and then I would go inside for dinner, and then I'd go back out, and I would, then go around the loop that I'd created.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't know what it was, but I was definitely okay with being by myself. I was definitely okay with being outside at night because, you know, it's dark there after mm-hmm. 4 o'clock. And I certainly wasn't afraid of hard work. And I obviously didn't need someone telling me, you know,
yeah,
to do this. All those things came naturally for me. But I hadn't really thought of the idea of competing. And in seventh grade, I was in the play Tom Sawyer, and I looked out the window in the springtime, and I saw a bunch of kids running, and we had a really enthusiastic running coach at my school,
mm-hmm.
and who was always recruiting,
mm-hmm.
And he asked me if I'd ever considered going out for the running team, and so in the fall of my eighth grade year. I decided to go out for cross-country running. And I think that's how I found out about the whole competitive piece. And so I had some success with it, enough to want to keep doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't a standout by any means, but I liked how it felt, and I could see myself getting better. And so I ended up focusing on running for a lot of those years.
So would you consider yourself an innately competitive driven person?
I'm certainly competitive. I don't consider myself an overly driven person. I I find myself, if I find something that I'm interested in doing, I'll make sure that it gets finished and I'll make sure that I do a good job doing it.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't feel compelled to move from one thing to the next. You know, I'm okay with not having a process at any given time.
So I have a philosophy about competition, or a belief about competitiveness, that there's three different types. One is the I win, you lose, more competitive team sports type of competition where we have to beat that person. And then there's the individual sports type of thing, like cross-country skiing or swimming, where I want to beat myself. I want to beat my time. And then there's the competitive drive that I find in music or even rock climbing, where I've never done that before. Let's see if I can do that. What's your take on this, and which one of those would you consider yourself?
I think it's really neat that you've broken those down for yourself. I can see a piece of me in all of those.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of times it depends upon what it is you're doing or where you are in your life. I asked a friend once about, I was really intrigued by this guy. His name is Carl Swenson, and he was a very good cross-country skier. He qualified for the Olympics in skiing and world championships in skiing, and he also qualified for the world championships in mountain biking. He was a very gifted athlete. Mm-hmm. And I asked him about that one time. I'm like, what are you thinking about when you're on the starting line? And he looked at me and he said, I look down the left side of the line, I look down the right side of the line, I say, I'm going to beat every one of these people today.
Mm-hmm.
And that was almost a slap in the face to me. Like, I had never considered that.
Yeah.
Because I came from, you know, only child, you know, spending a lot of time by myself in the woods. For me, it already was a really intrinsic thing. You know, the perseverance, struggle, overcoming,
mm-hmm.
You know, how hard can I push myself?
How much better can I get?
Exactly. And I basically taught myself to do it. And so for me, the whole competition thing is, it's internal and intrinsic. Then again, at the end of a race, if there's someone near me, it shifts into, I want to beat that person. And so I think it all depends upon the situation.
Yeah.
You know?
I think I know where you're going with this, where it just kind of starts as, you know, my experience has been, I like the collaboration. I like the artistry of athleticism, of trying to improve, trying to refine, trying to get that neuromuscular connection down just right, where you don't have to think about it and you can just go. But there does come a point when it's getting close, when you know you're just behind that person, but you can see the finish line. You're thinking, okay, just a little bit more. I can get him. I can get him. I can get him. I can beat him. I can beat him. That's something that just kind of has overtaken me at times.
Yeah.
Is that what you're describing?
Well, if you look at it this way, it takes thousands and thousands and thousands of hours to master
mm-hmm.
something.
Mm-hmm.
And most of that time, if you're not on a team, if you're not playing a team sport, is done by yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you can only motivate yourself to try to beat another person and you're doing an individual sport, it's incredibly hard because it's not very often that you're actually facing another person.
Mm-hmm.
You're mostly facing yourself. So that part of the competitive spirit has to be driven internally.
Yeah.
The other one I think is more, you know, old brain, if you will, like flight or fight.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you're faced with that adversary, I think you have to be able to figure out how to use that as a competitive advantage too. And that has to be trained as well. And I think that gets trained in competition. And then the final piece, the one that you stated about asking yourself to try something that you haven't done before to see if you can actually do it. I think is a really, if you stay in athletics long enough, you realize that you can't do the same thing over and over. I mean, if you do the same thing expecting different results,
mm-hmm.
there's a definition for that.
Yes, insanity.
Insanity. And so the nice part about a lot of today's modern individual sports is that there's so many other things that you can do to augment. And one of the things that I think that you learn from the intrinsic drive of competition is that a person is capable of learning something new, mm-hmm. and adapting, which makes learning how to rock climb, or which makes learning to surf, or, you know, trying new things, it makes it really possible, because you can manage your own personal competitive spirit, and it doesn't become your Achilles, it becomes your driver. Mm-hmm. And so I'm glad that you brought that to my attention, those three different aspects. But I think if you really understand yourself and you really know how to drive yourself internally through competition, you can find success in those other ones.
Yeah. And I think those three different types of competitions, that one could be successful at a high level. You know, like your friend looks down the line and says, I'm going to beat every one of these guys today. Another person with the second competitive drive would be, you know what? I may win, I may lose, but as long as I outperform myself, then it's a good day. And if that outperformance of myself also outperforms the rest of these guys, then well, yay for my team.
Absolutely.
And I think, and I'm sorry that goes back to a conversation you and I had before we started this podcast that maybe we shouldn't dive in right now, because it applies as far as finding your true source of the competitive drive and your reason why we do things. You want to elaborate on what you shared with me before?
Yeah,
where did your drive come from? That would be a good segue to this topic.
I don't know. I don't know what makes me more competitive or more driven than another person. At least when I started, I just found that, wow, you know, I have an ability to work harder or try harder or persevere or overcome or adapt
and suffer
yeah. And suffer is a really good part of it. And as I became older, I also realized that it isn't necessarily about how hard you can suffer. It really, quite frankly, is how good are you at having a conversation with your body, mm-hmm. between your mind and your body, to be able to maximize, mm-hmm. because the greatest racing moments are the ones that you almost feel like you're a third person, you're not even present.
Yeah.
And the worst ones, quite frankly, are War and Peace. They're the longest novel.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't matter what you try to do to make it better or faster or harder, you just seem to be going around in a cycle.
Yeah, you sink deeper and
Absolutely.
Deeper into your head of frustration and that downward spiral of momentum.
Yes.
But those moments of joy where you just feel like you're along for the ride and it's just happening before your eyes like a movie.
Yeah, and I think... I really do think I was, I don't know, blessed with two things that are important for someone to be successful in endurance sport. And one is the ability to quiet the brain under stress.
Mm.
And the other is just an innate ability to function physically at my, for lack of better terminology, anaerobic threshold.
Okay.
Which is the fine line between being able to metabolize the oxygen and mm-hmm. not being able to metabolize it. And that's the discomfort line that endurance athletes need to learn to live at. And it's always changing based on training and all sorts of factors, but some are really good at functioning there and some are not.
So is that to say that, do you think that you have a physiologically higher threshold, or you're able to cross that threshold and maintain more than another person?
I'm not certain that I can push myself harder than other people. I've raced against some people that are absolutely incredible at suffering. I don't think that's the precursor for success. I think success on the race course is being able to quiet your brain enough to allow your body to do what it's trained to do. I think that's the biggest hurdle for most people.
Yeah.
And the other part is the biggest factor is you can't choose your parents. You know, you're either genetically predisposed to a certain level with it or you're not. And But that also means that there are some that aren't as talented as others, but they do a better job of filling their box, if you will.
Yeah.
Right? There are some that are, we've all known them, that are immensely talented, but for some reason just can't quite get it together. And there are others that are, you know, on paper not that talented, but seem to get real far. And so, you know, it's a combination of the mental capacity as well as the trained physical capacity. And I was lucky to have for lack of a better terminology, a big motor. And if you put a well-trained or quiet brain with a big motor, generally you're going to have decent results.
Gotcha. So then let's get back to your story about you were running, you were enjoying it, you were pursuing that, you were skiing because that's just what you did.
Yes.
So take us through the timeline of was Lillehammer the first Olympics that you went to?
Albertville. 92.
So fast forward to you becoming an Olympian.
Okay. Basically, I did not do a lot of ski racing as a kid. In my sophomore year in high school, I thought to start a cross-country ski program at our high school because I wanted to do something that would augment my running training. And so we found, you know, like club sports always do, you find some teacher that seemed would fit to be able to help start a program. And we started a ski program at our high school, myself and a couple other friends. And I started having success with that as well, to go along with the running. And I was a state champion in running, and I was a state champion in skiing, and I had to decide, I was starting to have to make a decision as to what was going to be my sport.
Mm-hmm.
And there were recruiting offers that were coming in for running, but there aren't that many scholarships and recruiting offers that were coming in for skiing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I remember having a conversation with myself about, you know, what did I want to do? Because I had already, by this point, I had identified myself as an athlete.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay.
And so I realized that I could probably be national class in running, but I could probably be international in skiing. And so...
So is that why you... Now, it seems to me that with running, there was a greater opportunity for a little bit more fame. Let's just call it fame. But that wasn't your motivation, was it?
You know, it would have been much easier to get skiing paid for, or running paid for college. That's the way I looked at it.
Mm-hmm.
If I would have chosen running, I could have gotten a scholarship. There weren't any available for skiing. At least I didn't know that. And so I decided, I'm like, I should give this a try. So I took a year off and I went to Stratton Mountain School in Vermont, which is a ski academy, and then qualified for World Junior Championships on this year off.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden, it all became obvious to me. It's like, okay, I can see now that I want to be an international skier. And after that year, then I went to the University of Colorado and I skied there. This is one of my favorite things. That was my worst time as an athlete. I got worse every single year. And in my senior year, I was 26th at NCAAs. And 2 years later, I was 26th at the Olympics. And something happened in there around the time that I graduated where I was like, okay, if I'm gonna do, I really don't wanna get a job. I'm not motivated by anything right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll be really disappointed if I don't take the skiing thing to the limit.
Just to see. That third form of competition. Let's see if I can do that.
Let's see if I can do it, exactly. And I had the tools, I had the training, and, you know, but I hadn't really actually maximized my ability, physical ability. And so I left college and decided to go for it. And 2 years later, I was at the Olympics.
And as you said, through your college career, you got worse.
Yeah.
But yet that still led you to the Olympics 2 years after college.
Mm-hmm.
So can you flesh that out for me? What happened? Why have you identified where the decline came from? Which is funny that we call it a decline because it And still went to the Olympics, but still.
Yeah, I mean, everyone has setbacks. It doesn't matter whether it's...
I mean, were there injuries? Was a mental girlfriend?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
It was all those things.
All the above.
You know, it was school. It was a social life. It was maybe a needed,
what am I missing out on?
Sure.
Yeah.
And maybe subconsciously a needed break from pushing myself really hard mm-hmm. in high school as you know, I think I grew 5 inches and put on 50 pounds my freshman year in college. And that's a pretty good indication that I had suppressed myself physically from all the work that I had done.
Mm-hmm.
We see that sometimes with kids that come from really hard charging programs and they kind of back off a little bit. And next thing you know, they're sprouting.
They get the rest their body needs.
Yeah. And so, I had a good time at college. I went to a fun college. It was fun to be part of the ski team. I was on scholarship. There was no reason for me to excel other than, you know, the frustration of not being All-American.
Gotcha. So your experience of going through college, going to Albertville, and then was it 2 years or 4 years later? That was the switch.
Yeah.
Okay, so 2 years later, you went to Lillehammer. Well, first of all, how did you do in Lillehammer?
My best race in Albertville was 26th in the 10K Classic, and my best result in Lillehammer, I think, was 28th in the second day of the pursuit, the 15K skate. I did not race as well at Lillehammer as I did at Albertville. The year between 93, which was the World Championships in mm-hmm. Falun, Sweden, that was probably the pinnacle of my international ski racing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just like all things, I had a pretty fast rise and then it sort of flattened for a bit. Yeah. And then it went down a little bit and then changed it up, moved to Bend, got a different coach, changed my training style, and then, of course, ramped back up again. So, I mean, it's like all things, it ebbs and flows.
And it's such a dynamic daily thing.
Yes.
Which is funny. I mean, the person that won today could have lost the day before. Happens all the time.
Yes.
So, as far as the skiing goes and the placing and the history, now we are, 20 years out?
We're a long ways away.
We're a long ways away from that. We're a long ways away from that.
Yep.
So now we have the blessing of maturity and hindsight.
Mm-hmm.
What did that experience teach you? What were the life lessons that you share with the kids you work with today?
You know, a few days ago, I would have come in with a certain answer, but listening to one of your podcasts.
Thank you, by the way.
Yeah, and I wish I could remember the guy's name. I know he was an offensive lineman for the Packers.
Ken Rutgers.
Okay.
Yeah, episode 13, part one and part two. Anyway.
So I was doing a little bit of research here to try to get a feel for how this was going to go, and I listened to parts of the podcast, and one of the things that Ken said, which had never dawned on me before, was that people come into sport and stay in sport for basically two reasons.
Mm-hmm.
One is anger and the other is joy.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you've done any sort of reading on personality and moods and things, you realize that anger is a secondary emotion. It's generally a reaction to some other thing. And whether that's loneliness or sadness or shame or whatever it is. And when he said that, it was just like, it was cathartic for me. I had never even realized that, you know, that was it. But it was for me. You know, I wasn't very good at team sports, kind of a loner, couldn't really find my niche, what I was associated with.
Mm-hmm.
I was kind of a weakling, and I was a pretty emotional kid.
Mm.
And all of a sudden, I was seeing some success in sport.
So you tasted of the fruit and you wanted more.
Yeah. I mean, here I got into this because I was reaching out to try to prove that, you know, I was capable of something, and then all of a sudden I actually was. And so I think I used that anger. And anger can be in a lot of different ways. I mean, I didn't realize that I was angry, but I just, maybe it was just that became driven. And I was really driven. And it was mostly like, I'm going to show these guys, you know, I will be the best athlete at our school. I will be the best athlete in the state. You know, I'm going to succeed at a really high level at doing this. And it worked fairly well. Got me pretty far. But one of the things that what dawned on me, you know, somewhere in my professional ski life when I was chasing the snow and I was on the road 12 months out of the year, and I would go from the Western United States to the Southern Hemisphere to Alaska to Europe and back to the Western United States. And I did this for 6 or 7 years. Didn't own a bed, you know, barely owned enough to fit into my Subaru.
We'll ski for food.
Exactly. And that's exactly the point, is we'll ski for food. This is a time when we weren't really allowed to be professionals, and we were sort of lucky if we won some prize money and we received some broken time from companies. But, you know, we're talking a few thousand dollars a year. And the ski team's budget for cross-country skiing was a few hundred thousand dollars a year. And so when you're competing at the highest level against countries who are putting millions of dollars into the sport,
where's their national sport?
Right. Yeah. Or they're making a political statement by putting millions of dollars into it. Mm-hmm. You know, I used to race against the old Soviet era countries, and you know, they cared very much, and they cared enough that they were willing to do whatever it took.
The benevolent side of the Cold War.
Absolutely.
Okay. Yeah.
And so our small group, you know, my friends that are still coaching at the highest level and still pushing, because we are catching up. Americans are catching up, and we're doing very well in cross-country skiing right now. But we realized that we were up against insurmountable odds to win, for whatever reason. And so it sort of dawned on us that, look, if we're going to have this lifestyle, there's no sense beating ourselves up about running up against the wall that we're finally not going to climb. And so we just decided, you know, I did for myself, and my guess is a lot of my friends did as well, that we better start having a good time, because it gets really hard finishing 55th every single weekend. Mm. And maybe on the best day we break the top 30. And so it was really humbling. And that's where I came up with this whole idea that, you know what, there's always someone smarter, richer, funnier, faster, better looking, whatever. And so it's a pretty shallow thing to think that you're going to be the best when you just realize that maybe it's just not going to happen.
Well, and I listen to people throw that term around a lot. I want to be the best. I want to be the best. And I don't know that every single one of those people that I've had the conversation with who makes that comment has really stopped and truly considered what it takes, what the sacrifice would be, how much suffering it would be to literally be the lone person on the top of the mountain that's strewn by jetsam of lesser people. That takes a one in a billion willing to sacrifice and suffer.
Yeah, I mean, we see how hard it is even for those people. Look at Michael Jordan. Mm-hmm. Look at Michael Phelps. I mean, look at these guys that are not even arguably, they are the best that have ever lived in the sports they've done. And even they still have a hard time accepting it.
And so the question, if I could ever get one of those guys on my podcast, the question I want to ask them is, you are the best. You are the man on top of the mountain. Was it worth it? Would you change anything?
And that's the catharsis that I got with, and it made me think, I've thought about it a lot since listening to the podcast about the whole joy piece. And, you know, it just dawned on me. I'm like, okay, I can still do this. It's still a passion of mine. Mm-hmm. I can still be very good at it. I can still train really hard and try really hard and give myself a chance every time that I'm racing. But if I'm not having a good time doing it, then I'm certainly wasting my time. And so that's where the whole joy piece came in. And I started ski touring more. I started traveling to more out of the way places to do my training. I, you know, back in the old days, you could cut firewood and bend and make money doing it. Mm-hmm. You know, so I started one of those businesses for training, and it worked out really well.
Oh yeah.
And coincidentally, my race results actually improved, and so I'm like, hey, this can work too. But, you know, it doesn't matter whether you're coming at it from anger or from joy. You still have to have an incredibly strong work ethic. And you still have to be incredibly honest with yourself. And you still have to be, you have to be willing to push yourself really hard. But there are different ways to push yourself. And one can be about self-exploration and the other can be about self-flagellation. But, you know, you can make that choice. You can learn that choice. You can teach that choice. You can experience that choice. And I think that that's why I still really, really love the sport of Nordic skiing. And I'd like to think that I don't have a chip on my shoulder about my race results. They were fine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't really necessarily identify myself as an athlete anymore, but I certainly define myself as someone who likes to teach the joy of the sport.
And so where did your joy of teaching begin? We've seen your skiing background. So where did you start teaching? Where did that part of yourself come to be?
You know, I had when I moved to Bend, I changed coaches and changed my training plan, and my race results really, really improved. But I think the ski team was sort of over me at that point. And so I didn't get a chance to travel internationally much after 96. Mm. And so my career sort of wound down, and I worked in a car restoration shop here in Bend for 3 years. And then in 2000, Russ Reed, who was a longtime director of MBSEF and also the director of JBARJ, great, great man. We sat down and he asked me if I'd be interested in being the head Nordic coach over at MBSEF. And that's when it started in 2000.
Oh, nice. So in 2000, is that when you switched roles from athlete to coach?
Yes.
Basically?
Yes. And had no idea what I was doing.
So I would imagine, like many athletes, I'm sure probably the same with musicians who try and give lessons, there's that old saying of there's those who can, and then there are those who teach.
Yes.
So were you one of those who did and started trying to get into high level technique and racing mentality with kids who were strapping skis on for the first time?
You know, I did have a part of me that was pretty easy that segued nicely into coaching, and that was the technique aspect.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't have coaches back when I was a kid. Nobody knew anything. And so we had to teach ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And when you teach yourself, you have to come at it from so many different ways to figure out how you learn. And I think that lends itself to teaching.
Yeah.
Because what they're trying, you've probably tried. And what they're doing, you can probably mirror or mimic. And so you know the verbal and the kinesthetic and the visual parts. The part that was hard was not superimposing a professional training plan onto 13-year-olds.
Gotcha.
And it took a long time to figure out how to train adolescents. There's not a lot of research out there for endurance sport for adolescents. And it's, you know, because they'll do anything, they'll try anything, and they're fairly resilient. So the problem is, as you start throwing heavy stuff at them, they'll do it until they fall over. And the problem is when they fall over, they can't respond mm-hmm. very quickly.
Well, I know from my own experience of having taught kids, worked with kids in a junior lifeguard program, and also coaching water polo or assistant coaching for a little while, that because I played at the college level and then I'd go back and teach at a high school level, I kind of had certain assumptions that they already knew how to pass from either hand, you know, off their side, off balance. Mm-hmm. And when I realized that what I was talking about or some of the things that I was trying to get across that I was just several steps ahead of where they were, I had to stop myself. And I kind of harken back to my experience with junior lifeguards too, is like, let's find out where they are. and then help them take that next step. But that was on me to figure out what these steps are, how to get them from point A to point Z. But first we have to get to B and C and D first.
Yes.
But I had to figure out how we can connect those dots. And as a coach, that was the important thing for me.
And that's the key with understanding when an athlete comes into coaching, they have to understand that coaching is not the same as doing.
Mm-hmm.
It's very different. And I sort of hedge my bets by spending more time playing and being off trail out in the woods, because a kid moving, anytime they're moving, they're improving.
Mm-hmm.
They're not like us. They don't have to work on balance, you know?
Yeah.
They don't have to, those things are already innately there.
They are trying to find the path of least resistance, which translates to efficiency.
Yes. Right. And, you know, this might fall dead on our listeners' ears, but to give you a description of developing an aerobic animal, which cross-country skiing is an aerobic sport by and large.
Yes. In fact, let me interject. I'm very proud about this little tidbit. I think it was two Winter Olympics ago where I was watching the Nordic skiing, and the announcers were talking about the fitness level of these athletes. I mean, it was one of the highest of all Olympic athletes. And then they chimed in and said, yes, and studies have shown that the two fittest athletes in the Olympics are the Nordic skiers and the water polo players.
No kidding.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. I'll high five you after this is over.
Perfect. And so for me, the analogy that I make for the kids to understand about what it's like to be an adolescent trying to do an aerobic sport, because adolescents basically, they buffer everything with ventilation, breathing,
mm-hmm.
lactate, which is the thing that we all hate, right? As adults, yeah. It's the burn.
Mm-hmm.
The ability to recover quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so they do everything with high heart rate, high ventilation, high lactate, and they need to rest.
Yeah.
And then they can just go and do it again.
Yeah.
You know, five sprints kill us. Five sprints, they're just getting warmed up.
Yep. My paramedic teacher used to tell us that kids lack the volume, so they make up for it in speed.
And you can't just superimpose volume, because if you don't have the mitochondrial development to actually be able to handle the training
mm-hmm.
at an oxidative level, then all you're doing is making yourself tired.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's no set path on how an adolescent is going to get to the place that they become an aerobic animal. And to me, if you want to see how it goes, just watch Discovery Channel and watch the caribou. And the strongest caribou in the herd knows the pace that he has to walk while eating to keep the herd alive. And they can walk while eating, and they walk at the pace where they know that they're going to beat the snows,
mm-hmm.
right? And you look at the ones in the back, and they're the ones that have to stop to eat and then sprint to catch up and then stop to eat and then sprint to catch up.
It's an interesting analogy.
And
I like it.
And you realize that the ones in the back, all they're trying to do is not be the one that's the furthest one in the back, because that's the one that dies.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes a whole life for that little caribou to find its way all the way to the front to determine the pace that is going to be the most successful for the group.
And so that's a lesson for all the kids that join your program, is don't be the last one.
Well, yeah, that's on there. But they have to understand that it's a really, really long process, and you can't just take what works for an adult and shove it down the throat of a kid.
Yeah. Yeah. It's an interesting animal. And then, you know, we are getting close to that 45-minute mark, but there's a couple of things that I would love to get your insight on. Primarily, what is your take on the value of sport in the physical, mental, emotional, even the psychological development of a kid? What is the value of sport?
You know, and I jotted some notes about some of these questions, and I guess it all depends upon what you want to do with it. You know, for some people, the value of sport is mindless repetition. You know, for others, it might be necessary for well-being. I think we're coming to an age now where people have to move, because mm-hmm. if they don't, we're in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think, though, at some point, that if people choose to pursue an activity, whatever the sport might be, I hope that they get that everything is always in flux. I just had a workout with my top athlete this morning, Dakota Blackhorse, Von Jess. He's a national champion in sprinting. And, you know, he's one of those guys that he wants to be better every single day. And you could see his body language changing in the workout today because he was not hitting the mark. He loves to make it as systematic as possible. And I keep telling him, hey, this thing's really organic. I'm like, does Michael Phelps judge himself on every single split, every single time that he hits the pool? Probably not, because it would probably be incredibly frustrating for him. And so, you know, it's people have to realize that it's in flux. And I'm hoping that people realize to get out beyond their comfort zone, whether it's the same loop that they run or the same stretch of river that they paddle or, you know, the same weekly routine of exercise that they do. And also to, you know, allow the best and the worst moments to happen through their sport.
Failure is not a bad thing.
It's a great thing.
It's a great thing.
Struggle is awesome.
And I don't think we're talking just about sport anymore.
No.
I think failure is a great thing.
Yeah.
In general.
It is. And one of the things that you learn by failing in doing is that you really do ultimately realize that it's going to be okay.
Mm-hmm.
We're not living in barbaric times, at least not in Bend, Oregon.
Yeah.
And the choices that we make, if they're relative to sport, or they're through sport, or if they're involved in an activity, you know, the fallout of them is pretty slim.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I think the struggle is great. I think the flux is important. And, you know, I think it's allowed me to develop into who I am. And it's what I take to all the other things that I approach in life.
Well, even my six-year-old daughter has just recently got to experience this. A couple days ago, she came home and got a couple marks on her paper because she wasn't staying on task. She wasn't paying attention like she normally does. But this one day, you know, she wasn't feeling well, kind of hard to pay attention. And so she got a couple marks, and she came home and she was really sad, didn't want to tell us, but she told me. And kind of recognizing what this really could be, you know, I helped talk her through the process that, yes, I know sometimes it's hard, but we just try and do better. The next day we do better. But the value of that failure was, you didn't like it, did you? You feel bad about this, don't you? Now, take that fuel. Like we're talking about before, you can come at it from joy. You can come at it from a negative place, but it's still fuel and it's still valuable. And so using something as benign as getting a mark on your paper for not paying attention one day for a young kid, that's the value of that. Now we can extrapolate that to a bad day in sport and how to move on from that.
Absolutely. You know, one of the questions that you kind of led me into with this is that, how do I apply the lessons of sport to other areas in my life?
Yeah.
And I think that fits really well right here. And you know, it's an interesting question. I've been asked it before. Mm-hmm. I mean, granted, it's been quite a while since I've had an interview, but I tried to consider it a little bit this morning before I came in here. And, you know, I think the way that I approach projects and interactions is much like I've taught myself to respond to training and racing. And the first thing that I do is I tell myself that I'm ready to give it a try. Give it a try.
Yeah.
Next thing, I tell myself that it's going to work out. Right?
Mm-hmm.
I may not like the results, but it's going to work out. I'm going to be okay. You know, and then I tell myself that my personal experience is not that different than other people's. And I think that that's something that I try to tell my skiers a lot. Hey, what you're experiencing out here, everyone else is going through it too. It's just what you do with it. And, you know, once you kind of set your sphere with that, I'm ready to give it a try. It's going to be okay. My experience is no different than anybody else's. Mm-hmm. You're ready to go.
Yeah.
You're totally ready to go. And through sport, through activity, through all those things, you put that with that realization and you realize you're going to have the wherewithal to be successful.
Yeah. And it's funny, in different avenues of my life, sport, music, work, family, whatever, I have a couple little sayings that I use to try and get myself to a neutral state. You know, I'm not down, I'm not too inflated. I try and give myself a certain amount of humility, a little confidence, and get just that sweet spot. And some of these sayings are, I say often to other people is, you can do this. If they can shoot monkeys into space, you can do this, right? and another thing I always at least tell myself is, lesser people have done more. Mm-hmm. And then finally is, there's always someone better.
Absolutely.
And those three things kind of help get me in that, in what I think is my sweet spot of, I can, but don't get too full of yourself. Mm-hmm. Just be, find that moment, find that sweet spot.
I find it interesting that you just said that there are lesser people that have done more.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's important to realize, yeah, there are people that have done amazing things with not a lot.
Yeah.
And I think it just gets back to, like, keep it real.
Yes, you can do this, but, you know, don't get too ahead of yourself.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. What have been the high and low points of your career?
You know, once again, that 93 races in Falun, Sweden. It was fastest week I'd ever skied. I don't know why it was. I was like 5 pounds heavier than I'd ever raced before. You know, I was not an overly systematic athlete. And sport is so different now than when I was involved in it. With the nutrition and the training plans and the strength facilities and the myriad coaches that people bring and the technical things, fibers and equipments.
Were you more of like a kinesthetic, totally, emotional athlete?
Yes. I definitely.
So it was just, if it felt right, if it felt, yes, right.
Right. That's why the joy piece is so much easier for me.
Yes.
Now.
Yeah, I agree.
You know, I mean, my favorite things to do whenever I go to a place to go skiing is to basically just find the nearest trail that's as far away from the venue as possible and go explore.
Yeah. I think the worst thing I've ever heard any athlete do is measuring their food. I mean, really?
Yeah.
But I know it's very successful for a lot of people.
Some people, they need that, and because it gives, where I got my balance was by basically exploring.
Yeah.
And a lot of the places that we did race are, you can do that, which is really good for my sport, for me personally.
Yeah.
And I don't know why I was so fast that week. But you know, I was within 30 seconds of the world's best in my races over 6 to 15 miles.
Yeah.
It's pretty close.
Yeah.
And that was the Wild West.
That's a hundredth of a second in a 100-meter sprint and swimming.
Close.
Yeah.
And
just to kind of frame it in a similar terms, that's...
Yeah, and, you know, when you watch the old videos and you can see the race leaders and you can look just a little bit off the back, and there I am. And,
mm-hmm,
you know, and this was during the Wild West of performance enhancement. You know, this was the era when... This is the Lance era.
Where men were men and women were men.
That's right. And this was, you know, the same doctors, Ferrari, Cinconi,
yeah,
Testa, those guys are all involved. And so that would have been my high point. My low point, ironically, came a few years later at the World Championships in Thunder Bay. And this was the year that I was really systematic. My coaches were like, you need to lose this much weight, you need to eat this food, you need to train this way. It's near where my parents live, and so I actually took a week and went to Thunder Bay with my dad's, mm-hmm, truck in the fall,
mm-hmm,
and I brought a camera and a tape recorder and notepaper, and I walked every single course. I jotted notes every few meters, something that
mm-hmm,
I mean, I got to the point where I could visualize the entire 10-kilometer course to within a few minutes of how long it would take me. You know, people do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And worst week of racing of my life.
Oh, interesting.
So obviously my coach is telling me my entire career that I need to be more professional. I need to try harder. I need to eat better. I need to sleep more. I need to do this and that and the other thing. I took their advice finally, and it didn't pay off. And so that's when I realized I need to stay true to myself.
This is the perfect time for a Hamlet quote. to thine own self be true.
Right. So I moved away from Park City and I came to Bend, Oregon, found another coach, found another style.
Awesome.
Yep.
It kind of, for some reason, that kind of reminds me of in conversations we had earlier too, those professional surfers who, I mean, they're on the tour, they're trying to be professional athletes and this and that. And finally, there's just a few that break off and say, I'm tired of that. I don't want that. I don't want that regimented. I don't want that lifestyle. I'm going to go become, yeah, I think the terminology, at least when I grew up, was the soul surfer. But now they're finding and they're creating new ways, new income, new professional sports, doing their thing, and finding their own style and not trying to fit into this tight, narrow little box.
Yes, and the timing was right for that, and too, with the branding and also social media.
Yeah.
You know, because kids will pay money to watch a video of somebody free surfing.
Yeah, oh yeah. Yeah, I think it's crazy that they're getting paid to go live incredible lives, and then they're selling it, bottling it, and selling it to networks on TV, and I think it's brilliant.
Yes.
But you've been able to basically branch off and take your own style, so now you're living the good life in Bend and teaching kids how to find their way.
I have a great job, and this comes very natural to me. It's something that I really enjoy doing. I think I like kids better than I like adults. I don't know what that says about me, but it's really fun to be around dynamic energy.
Oh yeah.
And when we're kids, we're very dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
And the falls are not that far. They don't hurt as much.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, they're willing to try.
Mm-hmm.
And every day is a laboratory, and it's you know, if you can help them to understand pretty early on that we're not curing cancer and that they're going to be okay, it makes for a really nice, comfortable, safe environment to be able to try all this stuff.
Yeah. And there are times that I miss it. I miss working with the kids. I might have to head back in that direction at some point.
I'm sure there is plenty of organizations that would love to have you.
Oh, well, we will see. So as we start winding down a little bit, so you mentioned you traveled all over the world and you decided to come to Bend. Why did you choose to come to Bend?
Well, like I said earlier, I needed a break from living in Park City where the ski team was. Mm-hmm. And I came up here, Justin Wadsworth. He's a really well-known Bend person. He's the head coach of the Canadian ski team. And he lived here. And he invited me to come up to try some spring skiing. And I just remember skiing in the morning and going to Taco Stand after a good ski. And
this was 93?
This was 92.
92.
Yes. Spring of 92. And I'm like, I'm hooked. Greatest skiing, spring skiing on earth. Really low-key town.
Deschutes Brewery was 5 years old?
Yes, actually, one of my first roommates here was the second brewmaster at the Deschutes Brewery.
So I'm sure you did some quality assurance for the Deschutes Brewery for a time?
Things were different back then.
That'll be part two of this podcast. I can see the grin on your face. That
absolutely.
There's a story behind those teeth. Ben, how do you define and how do you live the good life?
You know, I think balance is the most important piece. And accepting where you are in your life at that point and learning how to balance that, I think, is living the good life. I don't necessarily know that it's attainable in a search. You either are living the good life or you're not. And I think...
So no grand visions of a quest then?
You know, maybe for some people, not for me. You know, I think wherever you are, there you are. And it's what you're doing with it. And I'm not certain that I'm always successful with it, but at least I strive for being okay with where I am and finding that balance. And it's interesting because I've never worked as hard as I'm working now. I'm working for an incredibly dynamic company, dynamic organization. We're growing really fast. We're adding more staff. You know, we're dealing with the issues that come with growth. We're dealing with families and children,
mm-hmm.
and the risk that comes with the sports that we do. There's a lot going on.
Mm-hmm.
I also recently moved with my wife and two daughters to the country, and we have animals and we have property.
Mm-hmm.
And I really like my kids, and I love spending time with my kids, and I would choose to spend time with them over anyone. And as you know, you personally know, it takes a lot of time.
It does.
And if you want to do a good job, you cannot put your children on your agenda.
If there was ever such a job to not suck at, it was definitely that of being a parent.
Absolutely. And it doesn't have to do with your own agenda.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, if you look at it from the outside, I'm incredibly busy, and I don't really find a lot of time for myself, but I still feel like I'm living a good life. And to me, that's just being okay with where you are.
And do you feel that you're contributing a value to the community?
I'd like to think so. I have kids that write back and say, thank you so much. You've been really important to me. I have other kids that tell me that the program is part of their college essay, which that says a lot.
Yes.
And, you know, I see smiling faces when kids get in their cars with their parents and drive home after practice. And we have a great group of staff here. And, you know, we're a young, growing nonprofit. Usually those are employed by very passionate people.
Mm-hmm.
And they want to come back and they want to keep working. So, you know, I'd like to think we're making a difference.
Yeah. Then what tips or advice would you offer to anyone listening? Kid, adult, somewhere in between. What advice would you offer to someone to live their good life?
Oh, yeah. I think it's important to develop the third person, to be able to look at yourself. We talk about that a lot with technique. The fastest way to learn about what you're doing or presenting or bringing or how you're acting is to be able to see yourself from the outside.
Mm.
And I think the best technical moments that I've had for myself is when I can actually see myself I can see Ben skiing. And, you know, I don't know, this might be a stretch, but when a person actually can see themselves walking, doing, thinking, being, you know, they have to be present to do that. You can't get there by looking at yourself wanting to be a step further. You have to be in that step.
You can't get there with an iPhone or headphone in your...
Well, that's a whole other story.
Okay, that'll be part three.
That's a weird deal for me to watch people Nordic skiing with iPhones or headphones. But, you know, I don't want to sound like a curmudgeon or anything.
Gotcha.
But I think, yeah, the good life is, to me, is if you can see yourself and you're present in that moment of where you are, then you're probably having a pretty good life.
Which, and of course, in this day and age, with the advent of iPhones, we can literally see yourself. So, I mean, when you talk about technique, what a great way to do it. When you're talking about just living the good life, it's a little bit more metaphorical than proprioception.
Yeah. Well, we don't use cameras when we coach here.
You use coaches the good old-fashioned way.
We do. Yeah, we try to get the person to be their own best observer.
Awesome. Awesome. Are you ready for my rapid-fire question series?
I am. These were hard.
Well, and I do have to say to everyone listening that by judging your notes, you appear more prepared for this interview than I am. So
there's a reason for that. I have given a boatload of bad interviews.
Oh, really?
Yes. I have a frontal lobe issue.
Oh, gotcha.
And I've been working really hard at trying to be more thorough in my responses. I mean, you know, I'm no longer a ski racer. Now I'm the director of an organization.
Yeah.
if I say something really stupid, it's going to come back to haunt me.
Well, I think so far we're good.
I hope so. maybe the headphone thing will get me a look or two.
All right. What is your favorite virtue?
Decency.
What is your favorite vice?
Gluttony.
Touche, especially in this town. What motivates you?
My children.
And what frustrates you?
Presently, our rooster, Napoleon.
You have to fill in the gaps on that one.
Well, when you buy a chick...
Rooster named Napoleon.
Yes.
Awesome.
When you buy a chick in the spring, it comes out looking... They all come out looking the same.
They're so cute.
They're so cute. And
until one day.
Somehow they've genetically engineered the hatches to be mostly hens. But roosters do sneak through.
Mm-hmm.
And we ended up with a white silky bantam, which means that it has a big tuft of hair.
Okay.
And my daughters and I watched the end of Napoleon Dynamite. And I'm not sure. It might have been the poignancy of the movie might have been lost on them,
mm-hmm.
but the names of the characters, Pedro and Napoleon, yeah. certainly weren't.
Yes.
And so we had a dark black banty that we called Pedrita, and then we had the white one, which we named Napoleon because of that tuft of hair.
Of course.
And Napoleon came out to be a rooster. It takes a while to figure it out, but then all of a sudden when they figure it out, you know, every morning I'm a part of Napoleon's life.
Gotcha.
And it's frustrating.
All right. What guides you?
The sun.
Then what distracts you?
My selective ADD.
Oh, okay. I thought you'd go a different way with that one based upon your previous answer. What inspires you?
A good rain.
And then what is your favorite quote or verse?
Ken Kesey's character, Hank Stamper. From Sometimes a Great Notion, which is a great Oregon book. Never give an inch. And at some points in my life, it seems so poignant, and other times it's just so ridiculous. And so I think of where I'm at. When I think of that quote, I'm like, okay, where am I on the spectrum on this one?
Don't give an inch.
Never give an inch.
Never give an inch.
And Hank scrawled it on the wall with a logging pencil. On the wall of the boys' room, and so I mean, you know, it's a manifest destiny story, and you know, east and west, and self-sufficiency, and you know, but at the end, it all just sort of fell apart, and so maybe they should have given an inch. I don't know.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, that could be interpreted either way.
It is for me.
Basically, like what you discussed with your training.
Absolutely.
Interesting. So. If you weren't a skier or an educator, what would you have been?
A pilot.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And then lastly, what do you hope to hear God say when you arrive at the pearly gates?
I haven't figured that one out yet.
How about now?
I'm not really sure how that's going to go down. We've been waiting for you. What took you so long? Now the fun begins. I'm not really sure about that one yet.
Or maybe just a big high five.
It could be. I don't know.
All right. Is there anything else you'd like to add? Anything you'd like to share?
I'd like to thank you for this opportunity. It's been fun. It's been nice to don't visit my ski past very often. It was fun to kind of go back there. I hope we didn't bore people with that. I really, really like this phase of my life. I'm definitely in a phase of self-discovery, rekindling relationships with a lot of people and kind of figuring out where I'm going with this next piece. And I feel fortunate to live in Bend, Oregon, live in Central Oregon. Yeah. I feel fortunate to be a part of this organization. And, you know, be nice, you're in Bend.
Yeah. Well, real quick story. Last March, I was at a convention and Magic Johnson was one of the keynote speakers. And his talk was about how he reinvented himself. It's like, okay, Magic Johnson, Lakers, okay, yeah. But when that was all done, then he was no longer a player. He had to reinvent himself.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that is a great way to think about the stage of life that you're in, and that I certainly feel like I'm in too, is how can we reinvent ourselves? Because I'm certainly not an athlete anymore. Not like I was anyway. Now we have kids. The focus is on them.
I think.
And how do we reinvent?
I think Magic is a great example.
Oh, yeah.
I think he's an incredible example. You know, I mean, that guy's, he's seen a lot, done a lot, experienced a lot. And, you know, he realized that he could be so much more than just a leader on the court,
mm-hmm.
which he was an incredible leader. He was creative. He was energetic. He wasn't selfish. And then to be able to do what he's doing right now, I mean, as an entrepreneur, firstly, and then as a community activist, and now,
mm-hmm.
you know, going into a sport that's not even his and buying a team.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think he realized that he couldn't just walk in and say, hey, dudes, I'm Magic.
Yeah.
And
there would come a time where, like, yeah, you used to be
used
Magic.
To be Magic.
Yeah.
And so he made
it. So what are you doing for us now?
Well, I'm making another Magic.
Yeah.
And, you know, I had a humbling experience a few years ago and had to restart with this whole piece, and that's why Bend Endurance Academy came to be. And definitely from that point forward, you know, I started taking a longer looks at what I wanted to be and who I am, and I'm thankful that happened. I think, you know, it's a good thing to be able to look at yourself at different places,
mm-hmm.
with different things. What worked then is not necessarily working today, and if it's not working today, then what do I have to do to make it work tomorrow? And I'm hoping that I can find a joyous way to do it.
What a great take. So last thing, how can people find you and follow you?
You know, I'm not sure anybody wants to follow me, but if they want to get enroll their kids in a program, or if they want to find out about what we do, it's World Wide Web, BendEnduranceAcademy.org. We also have a Facebook page. We're on Twitter and Instagram. We have programs for kids aged 4 all the way up to 19. And then in some cases, we have some adult programs. We're everywhere. We have hundreds of kids, lots of motivated families. It's a really, really fun thing to do. And come check us out.
Right on. Ben, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today.
I really enjoyed it. Thank you very much.
And this is Jeremy signing out. Hope you live your good life in Central Oregon.